Okay, so I will let you loose on the experiment pretty soon, but I have to give you some remarks before I let you loose. One of which is that the I haven't put your exam scores yet into Canvas, but I'll do that once I shut up. Do you have a feel for what the class mean was for you? No guesses?
65
is higher than my Tuesday. The section that comes after you.
Probably like 10.
They beat you by 9 points. The mean for this section was 55%, which is lower than it usually is. I mean, not a hell of a lot lower, but it is lower than the overall mean throughout my history. And I'll post all that once I get home or tomorrow. But a couple things to say about that is that this first exam is, for most people, the easiest one. And the scores go down from here. Now, there were some good scores, so I'm just talking about the class mean. That's the 55. But don't expect exams to get easier. Expect them to get harder. And also just remember that these are the meatiest of your scores, right? They're worth a lot more than anything else. So once I put them in, you'll see a bigger change in your total current score than when I grade anything else. And that's when you should pay attention to how much it changes your minimum required for a C, minimum required for a B, and minimum required for an A. Those, remember, you want to be low. Well, if those get high, then you're in trouble. Then you're in danger of not passing. So make sure you understand the effect that each graded item has on those summary and forecast numbers. Okay, anyway, back to today's stuff in lab. I've told you that on a typical lab day, since you don't hand anything in, that you're really done as far as points are concerned after you take the quiz, which you just did. But this is the first of 3 weeks that you write up as a report. So you're not quite done with today's points. You won't finish it, the report today, but pay attention to what the posted deadline is for the report. I don't have that memorized, but you should be looking at the assignment schedule page of Canvas frequently. That's designed to be a to-do list for you so you don't miss any deadlines. The report, the three reports, keep in mind, are not formal reports like you might have written elsewhere. They're simply a matter of doing the enumerated things that are on the description for the report, which is in your packet already. So hopefully you've already read what to do for the first report. Now, regardless of what the author of these packets says, you are not handing in any hard copy of any report. So don't try to hand me paper. My purse is already too heavy. So all reports have to be submitted via Canvas. They have to be in Word format. Now, it's okay if you want to hate Word, but you don't have the excuse of not having it because every student has free access to it. So download it if you haven't already for free. Canvas is set up to refuse any other format. But also, as part of however many things that you have to answer to do the report, you also have to construct a graph. And I don't remember what the author says in the packet for the instructions, but regardless of what the instructions say, your graph can be either hand-drawn or computer-generated, as long as you are comfortable making a hand-drawn graph. This is a hint. Consider this to be a hint. You will eventually be required to make a hand-drawn graph. Now, if you have no problem with that, then go ahead and if you prefer to do it on a computer, that's fine. But whether you do it on a computer or hand-draw it, you have to insert an image of the graph into the Word document of the report. You're not going to be allowed to submit separate documents. All right. So take a snapshot of a hand-drawn one or insert the image from a computer-generated graph into the document using insert picture. Everyone good with all that? All right. Let's talk about proper liquid measurement. First of all, I have a few concepts I need to get through before I let you loose on the experiment. There's all kinds of containers on your tray today, which you might or might not know the proper names of. These things are beakers. These tapered ones are Erlenmeyer flasks, or just flasks. All of these are graduated cylinders. They all have graduations on them, notice. They all have lines indicating different volumes. But you would never, if you want to make careful liquid measurement, you would never use a beaker or a flask to do the actual measurement. Those are there just as rough guidelines telling you how much you have in that container. If you want to do careful liquid measurement in an experiment, you want to use not only a graduated cylinder, or if it's smaller volumes, you would use even narrower things, pipettes or micropipettes. But if you're using a graduated cylinder, which, like today for instance, the proper graduated cylinder, because they come in different sizes, to use is the smallest one available that is big enough to do it in just one measurement. Right? If I tell you to measure out exactly a liter, you wouldn't choose this one because that you could do it, but it would take a lot of different measurements, each of which has a little bit of error associated with it, and those might add up to a big error. So you use the smallest graduated cylinder that is big enough for the job. But why, just in general, are graduated cylinders better for measuring liquids than the wider devices? What is it about the narrowness of a column that is important for measurement? Everyone hear that? See, I didn't. Well, that is true that happens, but that actually is a bad point about measurement. The point about it being narrow is that if you're delivering volume into a narrow cylinder, but you deliver the same volume into a wide cylinder or like a sheet pan, you know, you put using silly system units, a cup of water into a sheet pan, it's not going to rise very high, right? It's going to be hard to tell the difference between one cup and 1.1 cup. But if you put that same volume into a very narrow cylinder, a change in volume is going to make a big change in the vertical level of that, giving you plenty of room to put fine tick marks, in other words, higher resolution measurements. Does that make sense? That's why you use the smallest one that will do the job. But you want to do it in one measurement. That's why you use the one that's big enough. Okay. I also want to remind you, I think I've given you these definitions before, but since it applies to today, I want to remind you of what a solution is and what its components are. We're working with solutions today, right? A solution is a type of mixture, specifically a mixture in which one component is dissolved in another component, or dissolved by another component, either way. What is the thing that does the dissolving called? The solvent. And the thing that gets dissolved by that solvent is the solute. And there doesn't have to be just one of each of these. Now, in today's solution, what is the solvent? Water. So there is one solvent. What are you dissolving in the water? More specifically?
Sodium chloride.
So, based on what we talked about in lecture, when you put sodium chloride, which is a compound, into water, you really no longer have sodium chloride, right? Because the sodium ions and the chloride ions separate from each other and get surrounded by water molecules. So really what you have is a solution with two solutes in it. You have a solution of sodium ions and chloride ions. You don't have sodium chloride anymore. So there's two solutes today. But anyway, water is, in just about any biological situation, the solvent. Now, along the same lines, it's necessary at times to measure concentrations of solutions. And concentration refers to the relative strength, basically, the relative amount of solutes in a solution. If you have solutions of the same kind, meaning same solvents and solutes in each different instance, but they don't all have the same relative amounts of solute in them, then they have different concentrations. Right? The saltier the water, the higher the concentration, in other words, in this example. Well, there's different ways of measuring concentration, different units to use, just like when you know, concentration is a quantity. You have choices of units for any given quantity, like length, for instance. And so, for instance, you can measure concentration in molality. We're using molarity, which has units of molar, one capital M. What does capital M also mean?
Mega,
but it's no problem because you would never use mega by itself, right? Capital M by itself, though, means molar. You pronounce that as molar. But it's defined as moles of solvent, moles of solute per liter, that's what the L is, of overall solution. All right. What does this tell you molar is as far as what kind of unit? It's derived is the type of unit, right? It's, obviously it's derived. Concentration in general is derived because it involves two things. Solute and solution, or solute and solvent, depending on which ones you use. Anyway, this is the definition of molar. So what are your concentrations today that you're using? As you learned them when you studied the packet beforehand. Close. Those units are not moles. Zero molar, one molar, two molar, 3 molar and 5 molar, right? Well, your solutions are over here, so this is where you get them. Make sure you're putting the correct solution into the pre-labeled, you know, you label your containers, just don't mix them up, make sure you're using the right stuff. And you don't put anything back in here, but this is where you get them. All right, so this is zero molar NaCl. What is that? What's another name for zero molar NaCl solution?
Pure water.
Yeah, this is just pure water. But pure water is still a solution, right? Because of auto ionization of water. Even if it's pure water, there are still hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions in there. So technically, it still is a solution. These are clearly solutions, though, because they have water and sodium and chlorine in them, or chloride, I should say. But 1 molar, 3 molar, 5 molar, you do use those. That's where you get your liquids. These beakers with salt in them, though, you're not doing anything with those except looking at them to see how much salt is actually dissolved in a liter of those. So this is 1 mole of salt, 3 moles of salt, and 5 moles of salt. If you put this 1 mole of salt in enough water to make the overall volume of the solution exactly 1 mole, that by definition is a 1 molar concentration. It's moles of solute per liter of solution. Okay, and similarly for this is how much is dissolved in the 5 molar one over there in a liter of it, which is a full jug. All right, that's pretty straightforward. Next, I want to talk about variables, experimental variables. You're doing an experiment today. This is the first week that actually involves a true experiment. And in any given experiment, there are all kinds of variables, but you can group them into 3 categories of variables. Now, in an experiment, if a well-designed experiment, you're trying to answer a specific question. Basically, will a prediction come true that corresponds to a hypothesis? Right? But you really want to design things well so that most of the universe, which is full of variables, doesn't interfere with your experiment. What I mean here is that a variable in general, of course, by definition, is anything that can change value. And there's all kinds of variables in the universe continuously changing values. As a good scientist, though, the vast majority of those variables, which have nothing to do with your experiment, you're trying to keep them from being variables. You're trying to keep them constant so that they don't interfere with your results. And therefore, we lump them together as a category called controlled variables. Now, if you just use a simple example of an experiment in which if I were trying to test whether there is an effect of the concentration of a nutrient solution on the growth rate of plants, growth rate of a certain kind of plant, there's all kinds of things that might interfere with growth rate, right? But I'm interested in whether concentration of a nutrient solution affects growth rate. So I would want to have as many of my variables controlled as possible. For instance, I would, first of all, I don't do this with one plant. I use many individuals. You have replicates in experiments. So I wouldn't use just one plant. I would use several different individuals, but a controlled variable would be that I would use the same species, right? Because the species grow at different rates. Different species grow at different rates. So they'd all be the same age, they'd all be the same species, they would all have the same type of soil, all get the same amount of water, all get the same amount of light. Those are all controlled variables because I want to keep those things from interfering with my results. Is that all clear? Well, the other two categories aren't nearly as numerous. There's really no limit to the number of controlled variables, but you can control only so many things in a real experiment. Anyway, the two other categories are independent variable and dependent variable, which people confuse all the time. About half of people get this wrong when they're first learning it. And you can think about it linguistically, which I usually prefer to do, in case you haven't noticed that. But in this case, it's really better to memorize a practical definition, meaning based on how you use them. The dependent variable in any given experiment is the thing that you as the scientist actually measure in that experiment. Whereas the independent variable is the thing that you as the scientist adjust from experimental subject to the next experimental subject. The subjects are what you're using, right? And so the different pots of plant that I would use in my growth experiment, right? So what in that experiment, example experiment, what is the dependent variable? The growth rate. That's the thing I'm measuring, right? And the independent variable? Well, it's the nutrient solution is not the independent variable.
Is it the thing you're putting inside the nutrient solution?
Yes.
It's like how much you put right in?
Not the volume.
The difference?
No. The concentration of the nutrient solution. A controlled variable would be the volume that I give them. I would give them the same amount of nutrient solution, right? 5 milliliters or whatever the volume is. But the concentration of it would change in each of my replicates. That's the thing I'm adjusting, the concentration. If I give them different volumes, most of which is water, then it might be due to just wateriness, right? You want to control the total amount of volume of water you're giving them. But what I'm adjusting is the independent variable, and that's the concentration of the nutrient solution. See the difference? What is the dependent variable today? What is it?
The boiling point.
Yes, boiling point, which is the temperature at which the liquid boils. And the independent variable?
Molarity?
Yeah, it's the concentration of the solution in molar. That's what you're adjusting from replicate to replicate, right? In a well-designed experiment, there should only be that one thing that's different about each replicate, the thing that you're actually adjusting. Now back to the names of these variables, though. Think about it linguistically now that you've been given the practical definition. The reason the dependent variable is called that is because it might be true that the dependent variable, the thing you're measuring, does actually depend on the level of the independent variable. It doesn't have to be true, though, but that's why it's called dependent. And actually, an experiment really just boils down to testing whether the thing you're measuring, the dependent variable, actually does depend on the thing you're adjusting, the independent variable. And we call it the dependent variable whether it actually depends or not. But the reason that you go through with the experiment is to really answer that question. Does it indeed depend? And if so, how? Now, that brings us to graphing, which is often done in experiments. It's not the only way to present data. Tables are also used, and just paragraphs. But graphs are very useful, not only because they give you a lot of information at a glance, information-rich items, graphs, but you can also use them to make predictions. Anyway, before we get to the predictions part, if you just have a typical two-dimensional graph with an x-axis horizontal and a y-axis vertical, there's room for two variables, right? Well, which of the three categories of variables is not going to be on your graph? Controlled variables are not actually part of the experiment. You're trying to keep them from being part of the experiment, which would be an error if they were allowed to make a difference. So that leaves independent and dependent. Where does the dependent variable belong on a properly constructed scientific graph? On the y-axis. Now you would never label it like this. I'm just putting depth there for dependent. Independent down here, always. Now this is analogous to a mathematical function, which you can graph as well, right? But a mathematical function is kind of like a non-material machine in which you input something and it spits something out, right? Does something to what you input and it presents an output. Well, the independent variable in an experiment is what you input. And what you're measuring is the output, the dependent variable. So the y values are the dependent variable, the x values are the independent variable. If we use my plant example of the for an experiment, what would be my vertical axis label? Growth rate, which I would spell out, I wouldn't put GR. But even if I had growth rate spelled out, that's not an acceptable label. Why? Well, that could be in the title. But growth rate, okay, if I say the growth rate is 3, what the hell does that mean? 3 miles per eon? Yeah, you have to have units if your measurement is has a dimension, which most do. So in parentheses, you would say what you're using as units. For instance, I could use millimeters per week, if that's how I want to measure it. But it needs to be specified on the graph. Otherwise, your numbers are meaningless if you don't have units, right? Similarly, for the independent variable, which in this case is what? Concentration of nutrient solution. Once again, we have to have units because there's different kinds of concentration. So molar, for instance, like you're using today. Well, more about what a proper graph needs in just a minute, but you know, if I get real data from my different replicates, each at a different concentration, I might have dots that look like that. Now, those are not collinear, right? They don't fall perfectly on a line. But pretty close. It looks like there is a linear relationship here. Right? And if I were to draw a line of best fit, it would be pretty much horizontal in this case. First of all, before we talk about that horizontality, a line of best fit, there's really only one truly best fit line for any set of data. But a line of best fit does not necessarily go through any point, any of the real data. The line of best fit is the single line that gets as close as possible to as many as possible of those points. So you can draw that by hand or you can have a computer do it for you. If you draw it by hand, it's useful to use a transparent ruler because otherwise you'll be covering some of your dots. But I just drew a rough one right here. Well, it's a horizontal line. What does a horizontal line tell you about dependence? What? The y value is constant. And what does that tell you about dependence? Right, it means that in this case, what you have learned is that the growth rate does not depend on the concentration of nutrient solution, if these were real data. A horizontal line says, even though we're calling this the dependent variable, in fact, it doesn't really depend on what you adjust the x to be, you get the same y. You'd still call it dependent, though. Well, that's a special case, perfectly horizontal, right? Anything else means that there is dependence. If the value of y changes when you change x, it could be, if it's a linear relationship, which it doesn't have to be, you know, it could go upward or downward. Those are both dependences, though, right? In both of those cases, the thing you're measuring actually depends on the thing you're adjusting. So those are really the three possible outcomes if it has a linear relationship. No dependence, increasing, or decreasing. Now, a line of best fit, you know, let me This is pretty unlikely. I just wanted to show you the situation of no dependence. If my real data, for instance, looked like that, then my line of best fit would be approximately there. Now, if it doesn't, if it's not linear to begin with, then you wouldn't put a line of best fit. But this looks like it's pretty linear, right? Well, anyway, the line of best fit is more than just a nice cosmetic feature. It makes the graph easier to look at, which is a cosmetic feature, but that's valuable in its own right. It's much more valuable, though, a line of best fit as a measurement device. In a sense, I shouldn't say measurement, it's a prediction device. Now, the only measurements that were made here are represented by the dots. Those are real data. And it's our data, because data is plural. So you don't say data is, you say data are. Anyway, each of these is a real measurement that you made, or that I made in this pretend example. You use those to see whether there's a linear relationship. If so, you plot fit a line of best fit. The real utility, though, of this line of best fit is to use it as a predictive device in either of two very similar processes called interpolation and extrapolation. Now, what does inter mean? Now, intra means within. Inter means between. International is between different nations, right? And what does extra mean? Extra is the opposite of intra, which isn't up here. It means outside of. Now, there's a good reason we give these two different words, their own words, even though really it's exactly the same process as far as using the line is concerned. But I'll explain that difference in a minute. Let me first just say that to use a line of best fit, you really are trying to figure out or predict what the value for the dependent variable is for a value of the independent variable that you actually didn't test, right? You only tested certain values of the independent variable in this. Only certain concentrations are tested in this graph, right? The real data. But it might be useful to know what the growth rate would be for some value other than the independent variable values that you actually did measure at other concentrations, in other words. And doing that, if I say, what would it be at this concentration, whatever numerical value that is? I didn't actually measure that one, right? There's no dot corresponding to it. So using the line of best fit is really just a matter of going straight up from that x value and then straight over to the y and reading that off the scale. The line of best fit says, if this actually is this relationship that the line represents, then you would expect the growth rate to be this value for a concentration of nutrient solution of this value. That's not a measurement, that's a prediction, because you didn't actually do the experiment at that value, right? So that's the real utility of a fitted line. But interpolation means using this method anywhere in the overall range of x values that you tested. So anywhere between the lowest and the highest value, if you use this method like I did here, that's interpolation. But you could do it also higher than the highest value, highest to x, or lower than the lowest x. That would be outside of the range that you actually measured. And that's why it's called extrapolation. And the reason, even though it's the same method, same procedure, that we give it two different names is because One of these two methods is a lot more safe scientifically or statistically to do than the other. Interpolation is much more likely to be true than extrapolation. And in good science, you really want to avoid extrapolation. For instance, this looks like, according to the data and according to the line of best fit, that if I make concentration of nutrient solution really high, I should get a hell of a big growth rate, right? In other words, the line predicts that over here, that very high concentration should give me a very high growth rate. But I only measured up to this value. Maybe it's linear for this range, but if you get the concentration too strong, the real data might fall off and actually kill the plant. And so extrapolation would give you a very wrong prediction compared to what reality would be if you actually went ahead and tried those higher concentrations. Similarly, you can't account on that trend continuing below the lowest value. So this doing the same thing anywhere in this area would also be extrapolation. Anywhere between the two limits, though, that you actually did measure at, that's interpolation. You see why interpolation is better? Okay, well, if we have all of this stuff that I've put up here so far, that is not an acceptable graph for the report, for the purposes of the report, for instance, but just in science, it's not an acceptable graph. You have to have labels and units like I have, but you also have to have the axis itself numbered properly, right? Without any numbers on the axis, with no scales, it's totally meaningless. Well, here is one way that you can truly mess up a graph, and I can almost guarantee that several people will do this. Not necessarily in your section, but in all three of my sections, there will probably be several. What are your labels for today? The experiment you're actually doing? Concentration of what? Concentration of the solution goes where, I mean? Right? And we're using molar, so it would be the same units. What about dependent variable? Boiling point in degrees centigrade, not just C. C by itself does not mean temperature. Anyway, what are your values of concentration that you're using? Zero, one, three, and five molar, right? What I was saying is that I can almost guarantee that some people are going to give me 0, 1, 3, 5, like that. Skipping over all of their schooling about number lines that came decades earlier. Right? Those are numeric values. The distance between 1 and 3 is not the same as the distance between 0 and 1. Now, if this were a categoric axis, like red, green, and blue, don't have relationships to each other, then yeah, you could space them apart equally. But these are numbers. Make sure you put them in the right places on your axis, but the axis scale has regularity to it. Another reason this is not a complete graph, though, is it doesn't even have a title. A graph should have a title, and there are good titles, and there are titles that totally suck, like Bio 181 Lab. That's a terrible title. It doesn't tell you anything about what you did in the experiment or what the graph is portraying, right? The title should say what the graph is telling you visually. So it's not Thursday's assignment or anything like that. It would be, for instance, in this plant one, the effect of concentration of nutrient solution on the growth rate of plant, of the whatever plant it is. Now, it's sometimes we use the word versus. You don't have to, but there is only one proper way to use versus when you're talking about graphs. And the packet might get this wrong, so beware of that, because I've seen this author get this wrong before. If you do use versus, though, it's always y versus x, whatever y is versus whatever x is. Never the other way around. So it wouldn't be right to call this graph concentration of nutrient solution versus growth rate. Only growth rate versus concentration of nutrient solution. But like I said, you don't have to use versus. If you do, though, that's the proper way. Now, another problem that you... I mean, let's assume you have a title and you have numbered axes and labeled axes with units. It could still be a bad graph. For instance, if this is a whole page, that's a terrible graph. Use some forethought. Figure out what your overall range of x values needs to be and your overall range of y values need to be, and go a little bit below what the minimum is and a little bit above what the maximum is, so you spread your data out. It's a lot more precise that way. I mean, a lot higher resolution that way, but it's easier to look at as well. And don't think you have to have zero on any axis. If you have a bunch of measurements that range from 900,000 to 900,003, you would not make a zero to a million y-axis, right? All your data would be like this. You would go from 900,000 to 915,000 or whatever to spread those out. So that takes a little bit of thinking before you actually start drawing. That's how you do it. In both directions, spread it out. If you have a whole page of graph paper to work with, use as much as possible of it. So avoid doing all these things and you can get more points for your for the graph itself, which is part of the overall score, of course. Okay, that's what I wanted to say in general. A couple things now about the specific experiment. Couple things you can make a mistake on. It's pretty easy, and doing the experiment isn't even going to take as long as I've spoken. So we'll still get out early. One thing, though, is your heaters, which you can turn on right now if you want to get them fired up. They're big enough to actually put two flasks on, so you don't have to boil these things one at a time, or heat them one at a time. You can have two, as long as you keep your eye on them, you can have two different samples on the same heating device at once. But as getting your solutions is pretty straightforward. Just make sure you're labeling correctly and getting the right solution. That's not a big source of error. Taking a temperature can be as simple as it sounds. First of all, make sure your thermometer is on centigrade. And the big mistake you can make getting the temperature is to allow the tip, or allow the metal part of the thermometer to touch the glass. You don't want to touch the sides or the bottom. You'll get a false reading, especially the bottom. So it has to be submerged, of course, but carefully keep it in the liquid without it touching. And let it stabilize for a few seconds. If it's changing still, Don't write down the temperature until it's stabilized. That's all not a huge source of error, but it's possible. Probably the biggest source of error is figuring out exactly what boiling is. This is a controlled variable, right? The definition, what you're defining as boiling, needs to be a controlled variable. So you don't say, okay, this thing's boiling because it has a tiny bubble in it, and this other one is boiling because it's raging out of control. Those totally different boiling scenarios, right? So before you actually have anything boil, you need to come up as a group with what you're defining boiling to be. Don't make it be that first tiny bubble. Don't make it go to a full boil. Somewhere in between is best, but it needs to be consistent for all of your samples. So that's why it's best to have it in mind first at hand. And as soon as that condition arises, be ready to take the temperature. This is why you can't wait. Well, you could wait on one of them, the first one, which is pure water. If I were to have a device that continuously logs the temperature to produce a graph, a live graph of temperature versus time, at first, the pure water is below boiling, so it has some temperature, but as I heat it up, of course, the temperature is going to rise, right? Until it hits boiling point, which you should not expect to be 100. 100 centigrade is the boiling point of pure water at sea level, at 1 atmosphere of pressure. We're not at sea level, so don't expect it to be 100. But anyway, whatever that boiling point is, if it's pure water, it eventually will reach it, and then it's going to plateau. You can continue to heat that. You're putting in energy, but the temperature is not rising at all once it's boiling. Instead, that energy is going into evaporating more and more water into the gas phase. And if you were collecting all that gas, eventually you would run out of liquid water and it would be all gas, and then that gas would rise in temperature after it was all boiled. So this one, you could actually take the temperature anywhere in this range of times and you'd be okay. But the other three solutions have salt in them, right? Well, when a salty solution boils, it's not all of the components of that solution that go into the gas phase. Only the water is evaporating. You know, if you forget that you had a pot of salted water on the stove or fall asleep for hours, you go back to the stove and it's totally dry salt in the bottom of a waterless pan because only the water has left, not the salt. You have to get it a hell of a lot hotter for the salt to actually evaporate. Well, that's a problem because you're supposed to have solutions of a defined concentration, right? You want 0, 1, 3, and 5. For any of those ones that aren't pure water, if you don't get the temperature as soon as your definition of boiling hits, what happens? Well, when it's boiling, water's evaporating into the gas phase. That means you're losing water, but you have exactly the same amount of salt still. Therefore, what happens to the concentration of that solution? The amount of salt is staying the same, but the amount of water is going down. Right, it's becoming more and more salty. The concentration is increasing. So it's no longer what you're saying the concentration is if you wait. So that's another controlled variable. You want to get it before the concentration, you want to get the temperature before the concentration changes. All right, so carefully do that as well. Now, not so much about error, but just for safety's sake, you don't want these things to heat to above boiling, because then if you just slightly move the container, it'll all come out dangerously, scaldingly. So we have boiling chips, these little glass beads here. Just put 2 or 3 into each of your containers before you start heating them. Don't put any down the drain, though, which is why this bucket and strainer is here. When you get rid of your salt solutions, pour them through the strainer to collect the glass. If the bucket fills up, empty just the bucket, but keep the glass here. A quick final rinse of your flasks is all you really need to do for cleanup and drying any mess you made. But I think that's pretty much it. It's straightforward to get the measurements as long as you don't start talking so much that you don't realize the thing's been boiling for 5 minutes. Make sure before you leave that everyone in your group has the data. Now, your data within a group will be identical, right? You're sharing that. But importantly, every person has to write its own report. So don't share graphs. Don't do anything like that. You have to write these things on your own. Otherwise, you violate the rules consent form that you signed, and it'll be a zero for everyone involved. Don't let that happen. But, you know, you don't. All you really need to do while you're here today is get your raw data. The writing the report, you do on your own time up until the due date for that, which I think is a couple weeks from now or something like that. Any questions? All right, then do it. Oh, sorry. Well, I will allow either. You can do a 4 or a 3 if you want. No more than 4, though. No more than an entire table.